Welcome to our special programming about the novel coronavirus, featuring a conversation with David Quammen, author of the 2012 book Spillover, Animal Infection and the Next Human Pandemic. I'm Sarah Aronson, host of the Montana Public Radio program and podcast, The Right Question, which, along with this interview, are made possible with the generous support of Humanities Montana. I'm pleased to introduce to you Samantha Dwyer, who earned her Master of Arts in Literature with a minor in Art and an emphasis in Science from the University of Montana. She's a lifelong Montanan and the current program officer at Humanities Montana. She'll be interviewing our guest, David Quammen. David Quammen is a renowned science journalist and the author of 16 books. Spillover was shortlisted for 8 national and international awards, receiving 3 of those. We are so lucky to have David call Montana home. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Sarah. We are grateful to you and Montana Public Radio for partnering with us to have this conversation and reach a larger audience. And especially thank you, David. I first came across your book, Spillover, at the Montana Festival of the Book in 2012 when you were a gala reader for us at the Wilma Theater in downtown Missoula.
Well, and, thank you both. It's good to be with you.
Yeah. Your book really stuck with me. And all these years later, when we canceled our in-person programs and moved our Montana conversations online, you were one of the first people we thought to talk to.
Well, I'm happy to do it. And yeah, a mere 8 years since this book was published.
Yeah.
And back then, it was seemed like sort of a fringe topic to some people, or to most people, I suppose. I'm not complaining about how the book did, but it was like, oh yeah, really? Animal infections and the next human pandemic? Oh, okay, if you're interested in that, fine. now here we are.
Yeah. Well, I'd like you to talk to us a little bit about how the humanities might help us make decisions right now, and how history, which you cover a lot in your book, and literature, and the stories that science can tell us can help us decide how to react and behave as we move forward. As a science writer, how do you turn data into stories and stories back into science?
Yeah, it's all one for me, humanities and science, and you know, the things that we care about. As you said, the name of the game is telling stories. If you're a science writer, you can't just explain scientific concepts and present data. I mean, you can, but if you want to really affect the ordinary reader and people's lives, then you shouldn't do that. You tell stories, and that's what I do. I write about science, but I do it by telling stories about the people who do science, the men and women out there in the field and in the labs who are shaping our understanding of how the world works using science. Somebody reminded me recently that I had been asked who had influenced me most, what writer had influenced me most as a science writer. And I answered William Faulkner, because he influenced me more than any other writer in all of my writing life. A great novelist who knew how to put together a very complex book that had great emotional power, and he did that over and over again. And I was obsessed with him when I was a college student, and I did my graduate work on him and was obsessed with him for years afterward as I started my writing career as a fiction writer, as a novelist, and then I evolved into a science writer. But Faulkner and the things that I've learned from him and learned from reading fairly widely in history have never been irrelevant to writing about science. It's always part of one tapestry.
Mm-hmm. And you bring the people to life and the people who are doing this research. That's what I noticed reading your work. How do you find these people, and how do you decide, like, who makes it in?
Well, I think that's maybe particularly important in Spillover, because it's essentially a series of detective stories about where scary new viruses come from. And I went out with the detectives into the field and looked over their shoulder as they were capturing bats and trying to tranquilize dart gorillas to look for Ebola antibodies and things like that. How do I find them? It's always a little bit different. Sometimes I'm lucky enough for a scientist to to come to me and say, hey, I hear you're working on such and such. I'm doing such and such. Would you have any interest? More often, I find them by just reading widely in the scientific literature and in the general literature, looking for the scientists who are working on some aspect of a subject that I'm interested in, for instance, pandemic diseases and their origins in wild animals. So I read the scientific literature and I say, well, hey, there's a woman who is researching a particular strange new virus that falls out of bats in Australia and gets into horses and then passes from horses into humans. I wonder if she would talk to me, first of all, and secondly, I wonder if she would let me go with her in the field. And the next thing I know, I'm in Australia with Raina Plowright, or I'm in the Congo with a fellow named Dr. Billy Karish, who is doing the tranquilizing darting of gorillas, or I'm on the roof of a derelict warehouse in Bangladesh in the middle of the night, helping a fellow named John Epstein trap big fruit bats to look for a lethal virus named Nipah in them. And I'm always looking for the convergence of the important and the interesting. You can't just write about the facts and the ideas that are important, and you can't just write about things that are interesting because sometimes they're just not important. So this is a principle that has been with me for decades since I was writing a column for Outside Magazine once a month titled Natural Acts, and each month I would have to write an essay about some aspect of the natural world or natural science. And I would chase off after some flaky subjects and some strange facts and ideas. But it wasn't enough just to write about that. I had to chase those strange facts or ideas until the vector of what was interesting converged with the vector of what was important. And then that was the point where I'd start writing. Likewise, with looking for sources. When I do books, I want somebody who's doing important work, but also somebody who is interesting. Sometimes you don't know whether they're interesting until you spend 10 days in a jungle with them, and then you find out. Usually they are, and usually there's a story to tell that comes from some brief moment in those 10 days.
Wow. When you're talking about the places that you've gone and the people you've talked to, most of these, you know, Bangladesh, Australia, they sound very exotic to me here in Montana. And, you know, same with Ebola and AIDS and the bird flu that came out of China. And this disease, you know, even with cases in Montana now, it still seems primarily to be in faraway places, China, Italy, New York. Am I getting a false sense of security that we are kind of safer here in Montana and, you know, being somewhat isolated and a bit sheltered? Or where does Montana fit in this global ecosystem?
Yeah, I'm sorry to say, Sam, you are getting a false sense of security. This virus is here. It's definitely here. And where I live, Bozeman, last I checked, was by far leading the state in terms of confirmed coronavirus infections, probably because we have an airport that attracts people from lots of other places. And Missoula does too, but apparently a little bit more so right now. So it's here. It's everywhere. And distance is no defense against this virus, except the distance that you put between one person and another, the social distancing that we've been asked to observe and that we should observe, not just to keep ourselves healthy and our families healthy, but for the sake of our grandparents or elders or people that we don't even know. The more you flout those constraints about social distancing, the more you endanger other people by making it possible for you to pick up the virus, maybe scarcely feel it, but be a silent spreader and carry it to someone else. So it's here, and it's important for us to recognize that it is here. It's very different from the Ebola outbreak of 2014 in West Africa that turned into an epidemic in those three poor countries of West Africa, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. When that was happening, because I had written this book, Spillover, just published it just two years earlier, I was also asked to be a talking head on lots of media. I think I did five nights on the Anderson Cooper show. And people were saying, well, how scared should we be? How worried should we be about Ebola? And I was saying, man, if you're in the U.S., you shouldn't be very worried about it because this is not a virus that transmits very well. But you should be worried that a lot of people in those three African countries are going to suffer terribly from this. That's what you should worry about. Now we can worry about people all over the world, but we're entitled, well, I don't think worrying is really productive ever, but we're entitled to take this personally and to know that this is a threat to us and our families and our friends and neighbors in Montana. So we have to internalize that and act accordingly.
It's an invisible threat, and it's so hard to make some of these decisions to, you know, when you do feel fine, to still stay home. And
this is a coronavirus, as we've all heard. But when the word coronavirus was first spoken in January about this cluster of cases in China, I and anybody else who's paid attention to this, who studied this subject, shivered with dread because coronaviruses were at the top of the watch list, among those groups of viruses that were at the top of the watch list for a potential global pandemic. So as soon as we heard coronavirus, we thought, uh-oh, this could be the big one. There would be certain circumstances about this particular virus that might make it particularly dangerous. First of all, is a coronavirus, it has the capacity to evolve relatively quickly, to change as it replicates itself and adapt over time, adapt not just to a new host, but to the changing circumstances as we try and combat this virus that might even be able to adapt to the first vaccine that we create. We don't know that. But there are other aspects of coronaviruses. First of all, we knew that they could spread on the respiratory route. SARS in 2003 was a coronavirus, and it spread by the respiratory route. Had a high case fatality rate, 10%. So here comes another coronavirus. Oh, my God, we hope it won't be as bad as SARS in terms of case fatality rate. And, in fact, it's not. But it's much worse in terms of its transmissibility. It spreads much more easily than SARS did. And it has one other characteristic that makes it especially dangerous, and everybody has heard about this, and that is cryptic transmission, silent spread. Virus is shed from people who feel healthy. So they're walking around saying, I'm not sick with this new coronavirus, so I'm going to go to work, and I'm going to go to the park, and I'm going to go to Fort Lauderdale and hang out on the beach with 999 other crazed college students. That's what makes this virus particularly difficult to deal with and particularly dangerous, and that's what's allowed it to spread around the world so quickly.
Is it possible for a virus like this to originate in Montana?
It's possible for a virus to originate in Montana. We know this one didn't, but for instance, we have a very dangerous virus that's circulating in animals in Montana, circulating in deer mice, and it's one of the hantavirus group. It's loosely called hantavirus. This is something that people became aware of in the U.S. back in 1992 when there was a scary outbreak of a strange sort of pneumonia disease that was killing people, first of all, on the Navajo Reservation in Arizona and then generally in the Four Corners area. It was a hantavirus, a very lethal, potentially lethal kind of virus that that could be spread in the dust that rises from mouse droppings because it's excreted in the urine of mice. So people got sick and died there. And then there have been cases around other parts of the West. There are some scientists in Butte who have studied this for a long time, some very good scientists. And when I visited them during my research for this book, they took me out to their mouse trapping operation. And they pointed out to me that in some parts of Montana, 20% of the deer mice are carrying this hantavirus. So you can get it. You can get it by sweeping up the dust in an old shed and then breathing that dust. It's nothing unique to China or to Central Africa about this phenomenon. The only thing that's different is the amount of biological diversity in different places and therefore the diversity of viruses that exists within the animals and plants and fungi that live in those places.
We really are all part of the same system. and it's not right. It's not a national thing. It's a human thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep, for sure.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to a conversation with acclaimed science journalist David Quammen. Samantha Dwyer of Humanities Montana is the interviewer, and I'm Sarah Aronson. To hear the full interview, visit humanitiesmontana.org or mtpr.org. Stay with us for the second half of the program.
You've been thinking about this topic for a lot of years now. Are there conversations we're not having right now that you think we should be?
Well, I'm having conversations all day long on nothing but this. So I have a skewed perspective, but there are things that I keep talking about because I think we should understand them, internalize them, and talk about them more. And some of those involve the big picture. What's driving this whole trend of dangerous new viruses coming to us from wild animals and causing local outbreaks and sometimes national epidemics or even a global pandemic like this, what's driving the whole pattern is parallel to what's driving an equally serious problem, and that's climate change. Climate change didn't cause this pandemic, but it has the same ultimate causes, which is 7.7 billion humans on this planet, all of us very hungry, hungry for food, hungry for energy, hungry for products and consumption of all sorts, hungry to travel, and we're doing that. And all the choices that we make, what we eat, what we buy, how much we travel, how many children we have, all of those choices are putting varying degrees of pressure on the natural world, drawing resources and creatures and products from the natural world to us for our consumption. And as that's happening, we're drawing these wild animals from our diverse ecosystems more and more into our maw. And those wild animals carry viruses, more than a few unique viruses to different wild animals. And so that's what's causing the increase in spillovers. And then our interconnectedness and the density of our population is what's increasing the probability that any given spillover will turn into a national epidemic or a global pandemic. So we need to keep that in mind, that it's not just quote-unquote Chinese people who want to eat bats. It's all of us and what we're doing that increases the incidence of these spillovers and increases the likelihood that any one of them will turn into a pandemic.
Is there a story that you are hearing or thinking about right now or that you've come across that's significant to you that you would want to share?
Oh, lots of them, lots of them. One of them that I was looking at again yesterday is a case of a cluster of infections in the city of Albany, Georgia, that involved a particular church where a couple of funerals were held for, in each case, an African-American man who had died, and his family and friends assembled, and particularly in, I think it was the first funeral that occurred on about February 28th, I believe, man had died and his friends and family gathered. And this is right as we were starting to recognize that this virus could spread from people who were showing no symptoms. And the friends and loved ones went away and a number of them started to get sick. And there were eventually, I think, a cluster of more than 20 cases and a number of deaths from people who had apparently become infected, possibly from one fellow who had driven down from north of Atlanta to attend this funeral. And people were hugging and shaking hands and expressing their grief and their solidarity in important human ways without yet realizing how dangerous that was. So this was more than just a tragedy for that group of people in that community, Albany, Georgia. It was that plus also an instance of what's called super spreader events, which are events when a pathogen, a virus, say, of any sort, has an opportunity to spread from one individual to a large number of individuals in a short period of time. So that one individual becomes the source of more secondary infections by far than the average infected person does. And that's They call that person a super spreader. They call that a super spreader event, so as not to demonize the particular person, because the particular person doesn't know that he or she is causing this event. But it's one of the things that is driving this pandemic all over the world. A number of super spreader events where suddenly a whole cluster of people get infected, in some cases from one individual. Probably what happened at the nursing home in Kirkland, Washington earlier on was the same sort of thing. Something like 31 people who were somehow associated with this nursing home in Kirkland, Washington, I think died. I think it was 31 deaths and a number of other infections. The first big cluster in the United States, it was another super spreader event. So those are the things that remind us how this particular virus works, how highly infectious viruses generally work, and how cautious we have to be.
It's heartbreaking to hear those stories and to realize that, you know, the best way to show love is not to do those hugs and handshakes, but to stay home and to wear masks.
Right, for now. Yeah. Once this is over, we'll appreciate those hugs and handshakes more than ever.
Yes, absolutely. Well, David, I know you've been doing many, many interviews, and you have another one right after this. Thank you for the great article in the Missoulian and the Independent Record this last weekend. I hope Montanans can find those as well.
Thanks to Jeff Welsh of the Lee Newspapers, too.
Yes.
Thank you both for the opportunity to come at this subject from a little bit different angle. I really appreciate it. So stay safe. Be well. See you on the other side.
All right. You too.
Same to you. Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a thoughtful conversation with acclaimed science journalist David Quammen about his book Spillover, Animal Infection and the Next Human Pandemic. Many thanks to our interviewer, Samantha Dwyer from Humanities Montana. I'm Sarah Aronson from Montana Public Radio. To hear the full conversation, find a link at humanitiesmontana.org or mtpr.org. Be well and stay safe.